what ended up happening is I'm getting up early before my day job, putting in some work. During my lunch hour, I would literally drive my car to a Marriott hotel, park my car outside the hotel, steal the Wi-Fi so I could work.
What's up, everyone? This is Ankit from Forcepreneur.com, and you're listening to the Forcepreneur podcast. On this show, I talk to founders of profitable Salesforce companies and try to get a sense of what it is to be an entrepreneur in Salesforce Cosmos. How did it all start, and how was the journey until now? How do they make decisions both in professional and personal life? Our goal here is to learn from their examples so that the rest of us can go on and build our own profitable Salesforce businesses. My guest today is a Salesforce veteran, and I'm honored, excited, and a bit nervous at the same time to interview him. He is the member of the coveted Salesforce MVP Hall of Fame. He is the host on the Shell Black Whiteboard YouTube channel and the president of shellblack.com. Hello, Mr. Shell Black. How are you doing today?
Hi, Ankit. I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you for joining. So as I mentioned, you wear multiple hats. You are now in the Salesforce coveted MVP Hall of Fame, and you also did the YouTube channel, and now you're the president. So just tell us, how did you come into the Salesforce world? What were you doing before, and how did it all started?
I wasn't in any kind of IT or technical role before I got involved with Salesforce. I was really in retail operations with stores. And I stumbled into Salesforce back in 2005. I got an email from an old boss of mine that had just starting up. It was a Salesforce consulting practice, but it was also a general business consulting as well and some marketing. And so had a Starbucks, had a coffee with him, sound intriguing. And I think I took the leap of faith only because I'd worked with this individual before and I knew he was an amazing leader. And so I said, sure, let's take a look at it. And I'll take a crack at being a consultant. I was just finishing another job. So I was open to a new opportunity. So really, that was day one exposure. Never used it as a user, went straight into consulting. Back then in 2005, the platform wasn't nearly as wide and as deep. But when I was working for this consulting company, I had an opportunity to teach the Salesforce five-day admin class, ADM 201. So back in the day, Salesforce couldn't ramp instructors fast enough. And so they were going to the consulting partners just to find people who could teach the course. And that was really where I got a lot of my passion about teaching and those type of things is, you know, because I had to teach this class, I really had to understand Salesforce deep. And as a consultant, you know, your first two dozen projects, you may not go very wide or very deep. You may be just doing Sales Cloud 20 times in a row. Right. And so when I got into the instructor role, I was forced to learn security much better. I had to understand lead assignment rules much better. I had to understand reports and dashboards much better because I had to be able to articulate that and teach the topic. So that really, I mean, I think that was probably the best thing because I became instantly pretty solid on the platform very, very quickly. So did worked as a consultant for about 2 years, did probably 40 or 50 customer projects. And then kind of a weird change of events. An old school buddy of mine had a company and basically made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And he was in the finance industry. So took the check basically because it was a good salary. And I went over there and I kind of went through Salesforce withdrawal because they didn't have a CRM. They were running a lot of their operations off of SQL servers, Access databases in Excel and filing cabinets. And I was losing my mind. But I was in a role of strategy. I ran a project management group, and there was a project that hit my desk that was a perfect use case for Salesforce. And so I fired up a developer account. I configured all weekend, mocked up a demo for our CEO, and I showed this to our CEO on a Monday, how you could solve this one business problem with Salesforce. And he was like, this damn Salesforce thing you keep talking about. And I'm like, Yes, it is. And we were a customer by Friday. So within a week, we had bought. And of course, the Salesforce account executive was like, who are you? Like, how did you? We didn't even know about your company. And then all of a sudden, you're a Salesforce customer buying a bunch of licenses. And then built out a bunch of functionality, multiple integrations, a portal, multiple parts of the business was built out. And then it which was kind of interesting, because when you do a Salesforce project as a consultant, you don't get to see the baby grow up, right? You birth the baby and you get them live, but you don't see it grow over years and years and years. And so it was really nice to sit there and take a product as a customer, as an admin, and actually mature it and grow it out and refine it, which sometimes as a consultant we don't get to do. But then after about 3 years, everything was kind of on cruise control, right? Everything was kind of day-to-day normal care and feeding. And we had so much of our business in Salesforce that our CEO was really hesitant to keep investing more of the business functions into the platform. So then certifications came out 2008, picked up 3 certifications real quick. And that kind of scratched my itch for a little bit, but I still wanted to do more. Started finding a little bit of the early hints of the community out there. Twitter was just starting to come online about 2010. And I kind of felt like I still wanted to do more with Salesforce. I didn't want all my skills to go cold because I wasn't doing things day to day. And so I put up a blog, which was shellblack.com, which was not a company back then. It was literally what I was doing with Salesforce, tips and tricks, admin guides and stuff like that. And then, you know, it kind of snowballed after that.
Interesting. Yeah. So 2005, that is before Aloha or Classic, as we call it. So you might have seen some different views altogether, right?
Oh, yeah. So that was, well, we call it Classic today, but it's the old Aloha interface. But custom development really wasn't a thing. There wasn't an app exchange. Apex code was, I don't even think it was, I think it was more of a hack than a real language. You know, there was no community. It was, communities weren't available. It was the self-service portal or the SSP, which has now been retired. We had Google for AdWords. So you'll see that sometimes SFDC for AdWords in your org as a leftover relic. But a lot of the features back then are gone, and you know, it was still very powerful, but it was early days.
Interesting. And certifications came in 2008-9. I joined Salesforce in 2011-12, let's say, and the certifications were already like part of it. There were 6 back then: dev, admin, sales, service, and 2 more. Yeah.
When I first took my certifications, it was a Salesforce consultant certification, and later they broke that out into Sales Cloud and Service Cloud. So way back in the day.
Give us a quick, what does shellblack.com do? And now we have the question, how do we have the idea? And you bootstrapped, I believe.
Yeah, shellblack.com LLC is the legal name, and then Shellblack is kind of all squished together without a space is kind of the friendly name of it. So when I started the blog back in 2010, again, the thought was not a company. It was, and I would, if I knew that the end game was going to be a company, I wouldn't have been so vain as to call the company shellblack.com after me. I would have picked something very high tech sounding or whatever, or a cloud. Yeah. So that people asked me, like, why'd you call it after? So it was my blog. It was literally my personal website. And what had happened was people in the Dallas area, and I'm in Texas, would reach out to me and say, hey, I like what you did. You know, maybe we're trying to retrain some salespeople, or we want our dashboards refreshed, or our business processes are kind of a mess. Can you come help us out? And so that started kind of a moonlighting side hustle. And it was, you know, a nice benefit, but it wasn't, again, it wasn't the intent of the website. I was just trying to keep my skills sharp and, you know, engage and interact. And that kind of snowballed. And so then that first year was about $15,000.
Wow.
And it was just, you know, 4 or 5 months of the website being live and that growing. And then the next year, more people found me. And in 2011, which was kind of I still had a day job, full-time day job, but I did about $90,000.
Wow.
As a side hustle. And then I started having to work with some other independent contractors to just handle the work. And then what ended up happening is I'm getting up early before my day job, putting in some work. During my lunch hour, I would literally drive my car to a Marriott hotel, park my car outside the hotel, steal the Wi-Fi so I could work. So I would like to thank Marriott Hotels for my success, because I stole your Wi-Fi for a year.
No, that's a hustler.
I'm a Marriott member. I'm still loyal today because of that.
Yeah.
And then at night I would be a dad and then stay up until I would pass out, and I would just work and keep that going. And then, well, not too surprising, in 2012, it was May of 2012. I lost my day job, and probably not surprising, you know, you can Google my name and see what I am doing. So I'm pretty sure my employer found out that I had a second career going. And at that time, the decision to take shellblack.com full time, that decision was made for me. And it was, you know, kind of a hard conversation when you've got your wife on the other side of the dinner table, and, you know, we're about to lose benefits, direct deposit for your paycheck, your kids in private school, you have a mortgage and you have credit card debt, and you're trying to convince your wife, honey, this is going to be great. This is a great idea. Let's go for it. And, you know, and she didn't work. She had just finished working with the birth of our daughter. So it was a very terrifying year, because it would put a lot of pressure on me to make this happen. And I used to have a post-it above my desk, 5/1/2012, which was the day I got fired, and the word go with an exclamation mark underlined twice. And that I looked at every day, because I knew I just had to put in as much work as I could, because every hour of work that I delivered myself was pure profit, because I didn't have to pay payroll to somebody else to deliver it. And then I'll share that last maybe number. So after that year of, so the year I got fired, so I went full time May of 2012. And then that year we did about 420,000 in revenue. So it was, and then we've taken off since then, and I won't get too much of the details of our revenue, but that'll just kind of show you the scale over the first kind of 3 years, going from, you know, half a year full-time, part-time, and then what we did when I finally committed to making it happen.
Thank you for sharing that information. That's really informative for my listeners. You know, now they can see that starting an enterprise in Salesforce can be really rewarding as a business. So now I would just like to ask you a personal question. You were not fired because you had shellblack.com. Like, there were other reasons, circumstances, right?
No, it wasn't a conflict of interest. Yeah. So the person I was working for was in a finance company. So had I started a finance company, I'm sure that would have probably been a good reason. But it was literally, you know, it would be like having an Etsy side business, right? So I was doing Salesforce work on the side, not competing with my employer, but it's just what I was doing on the side. So, yeah, so I wasn't taking, you know, knowledge for how to work a finance company and starting a finance company. So it's a completely different sphere of customers.
All right. So thank you for that information. So tell us, what does Shell Black LLC do, and how big is your team size, and where are you guys based?
Good question. So we're a Salesforce implementation and consulting partner. So we strictly are consulting. We do not have products. We're not on the App Exchange. We have a couple of accelerators that we use for our clients around financial service cloud, but it's not something we have on the App Exchange. We don't want to be in the product business. We want to be in the consulting business. And there's pros and cons of that. So the cons is you don't have any, you know, subscription, ongoing recurring revenue. The pro in my mind, and one of the reasons why I wanted to be kind of a strict pure play consulting partner, is I think that focus is important. Right? Because if you're splitting your resources and, hey, we're going to be a software company and doing cost, you know, bug fixes and releases and customer support and documentation of our product versus consulting, you're splitting your resources, and it really dilutes your focus. And, you know, for the first 3 or 4 years of shellblack.com, I would say we were generalists, right? We would do anything Salesforce. And then you also have to think, this is pre-marketing cloud, this is pre-demandware, this is pre-health cloud, this is pre-Einstein, this is pre-CPQ. You know, you had sales cloud, service cloud, communities, and custom development, and what we call kind of bread and butter Salesforce. As we saw Salesforce 3 or 4 years ago start to do more industry-specific solutions, we focused even more, right? And I think this is how we've kind of broken out as a consulting partner is, you know, Salesforce is a 20-year-old company. They have lots of acquisitions, and we knew we couldn't be everything to everybody, right? We're not. And so when we talk to our customers, we say we basically focus on financial services today. And so financial service cloud, obviously, but it's easy to say what we don't do. So we don't do health cloud, nonprofit, CPQ, demandware, those type of things. So if it isn't part of the Salesforce product suite that can be leveraged by Salesforce financial services customers, we don't chase it because it's hard to staff one CPQ expert, right? You have a lot of risk only having one person that knows that. It'd be hard to have one person that knows nonprofit. It'd be hard to have one person and keep them busy that knows, you know, health cloud or Lightning Field Service, right? So that made us better. And so when we looked at our portfolio of customers, and probably because I was a financial services customer in the past, we had a pretty good, you know, story to tell. But then we pivoted hard. And when financial services cloud, we just doubled down on that. And as you look at our website, all our messaging is very financial services focused. And now today, 75% of our clients are in financial services. So that's just the direct result of focusing on it. And it just really builds momentum like a snowball because, you know, we can say we've worked with over 100 wealth management firms versus if someone says, hey, have you ever done deep sea oil exploration? Well, geez, how many of those can be done, right? And then, you know, if you can't say yes to that, Salesforce doesn't bring you that client. So you need that story and that portfolio to get new clients. To your other question, we're about a 40-person firm between full-time and part-time. We've got employees in all four time zones across the U.S. About a third of the team is based out of Dallas-Fort Worth because that's where we're based. And we only do U.S. So we're, again, that's that focus. We don't chase anything internationally across the border, strictly looking at U.S. clients.
Sweet. So tell us about what's your customer acquisition model? How do you acquire new customers?
Yeah, early days, it was a lot of SEO. Right. It was just a lot of content on the website. And I think that's harder to do now because there's so many people who are blogging and creating amazing content. Public speaking at Dreamforce. I've spoken at Dreamforce 6 years in a row. And then user groups initially because they were local and you knew you could service them. So if you did find a customer there. And you can't be like hardcore sales in a user group. You've just got to answer questions and hope that they want to talk to you. And then, you know, some traction with account executives. And it's really hard to kind of break through that glass ceiling with Salesforce account executives because if you're not at a super critical mass and you don't have enough stories in to tell, they don't want to risk their clients on you. But at some point, you do kind of bust through. And now 70% of our business comes from Salesforce account executives. So we've got a proven track record. We're not, you know, a startup. We're not two guys in a garage. We've got, you know, customer references. And today a lot of my job is pitching Shell Black to Salesforce. So in the last 12, 18 months, Dallas office, Chicago office, San Francisco office, Boston office, New York office, some of those offices all hit multiple times in a year, getting in front of those sales teams. And really just pitching, right? Because the turnover with Salesforce account executives is super high, super high. So you can't just sit there and say, oh, well, we saw this group of account executives a year ago. They know us. Pretty much 20-25% of that team's gone in a year, right? So it's constant remarketing.
That's interesting because that was one of the questions that I would have asked you later. But it's interesting because people sometimes underestimate the relationship that you need to have to the local Salesforce offices and also to the local Salesforce Ohana. And that's a very important thing that you mentioned about getting the first projects from the local community and just answering questions. I mean, I co-lead the Berlin Developer User Group, and here's the thing, I don't like people fishing for projects over there. Like, you know, some initially there were some people who were just coming there with the idea of getting more projects, and we were like, no, hey, first and foremost, it's a developer user group. It's about knowledge share. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, how do you get new projects or how do you acquire? And I'm like, you know what, come here and show your skills, do a presentation, and show that you know this stuff. You know, it's a little bit like fishing. You know, you have that prey, you put it on the hook, and you put it in water, and then you just wait.
You just summed it up perfectly. If you're just one of the smart people in the room and you have a lot of experiences, they will seek you out. So you don't have to sit there and chase them. They see you regularly. And for early days, it made a lot of sense for us because we were Dallas-based, and so we used the Dallas user group. And it wasn't a huge fishing bucket. We probably, I mean, I don't know if we even reached double digit customers out of the user group, but it's when you're bootstrapping, you every channel is something you need to focus on, right? So you just try everything.
Since we are talking about the local user groups and developer groups, and we saw the business side of it, what are the other benefits that you have seen with the relations to the local Ohana? And I mean, in terms of employees, you know, did you have luck with that?
Yeah, it's, you know, as an MVP, it's actually one of our core values on our website is kind of our relationship with the community. And, you know, we want to make sure people have time to give back to the community because it helped me out tremendously, right? I'm indebted to being an MVP and that visibility that that's given me. So, you know, we've been platinum sponsors of Texas Dreamin' in their early years. Rebecca Lammers, who's one of the chairs there, told me the story, and I didn't realize this till after the fact. She said, "Yeah, because you wrote that check, we were able to reserve the hotel." Like, they didn't have the cash. So I was like, "Well, that made me feel pretty good." We've got team members that run user groups. We've got team members that run Dreamin' events, Forcelandia, London Calling, Oklahoma City user group. I think the Madison, Wisconsin user group. We've got folks that blog. We have folks that podcast. Our team's pretty plugged in. We have a lot of MVPs on staff. And so it's important. I think I think you learn by giving, right? So it's kind of a two-way street. And I think we found some very passionate talent because we support the community. We could always do more, but you're also running a business. So it's kind of like you got to pick your battles, but we do encourage it.
Right. So that's very nice to hear that you are also supporting the local events. And now Jody Wagner is part of your team, and she was a huge member of the EMEA community. And she also brought us in contact. So shout out to Jody. So continuing from our initial conversation regarding the numbers, tell us, how has your revenue been and what's your year-on-year growth percentage?
Yeah, without giving you too much recent history on revenue. So our revenue is in the millions. It's been in the millions for many years. In terms of growth, I think you need to kind of look at the growth of Salesforce. You know, if Salesforce is growing 20% a year, that's probably a good metric for most partners to kind of think about, right? To kind of grow in the same pace of that ecosystem. It's a challenge, right? So, you know, there's 10,000 Salesforce account executives and people on the sales side. There's a lot of people who go chase, but you also have to remember there are thousands of partners that are also vying for their attention. So it's very challenging. But yeah, I mean, from a revenue growth, I mean, the good news, I can say we've grown every year. We've never gone backwards. But revenue growth percentage, I think 20% is a good number for most people to target.
Very good. So just to sum it up, you would say it's a very rewarding career and it's a very rewarding choice to open an enterprise or start a business in Salesforce realm.
It's the hardest thing I've ever done. There's a lot of sacrifices that come that way, but there's plenty of opportunity, right? Because Salesforce is not a declining industry. It's a growing ecosystem, right? So as long as Salesforce is growing, the attractiveness to enter that ecosystem is always going to be positive, right? So it's when a technology peaks and it's on the downslide, then that's probably not when you want to enter a market.
Sure. So that's what's going to be my follow-up question. So what have been your top three challenges running a Salesforce enterprise, and how did you overcome them?
I think as an owner, you know, one of the big challenges is that you can't turn it off. You can go on vacation and you will be thinking about it. You'll be eating lunch or a bowl of cereal and you're thinking about it. Vacations for me is usually I'll wake up before my family, put a couple of hours in the morning while they're getting ready for us to go do whatever we're going to do. But unfortunately, it is as much as you love it, it's also a bit of a burden, right? Because it's incessant. You're always touching it. I work.
It's kind of a 24/7 job.
It'd be the rare exception that I do not open my laptop. Like every day I have to go see what's going on. It's just part of the sickness of being an entrepreneur. And one story I can tell you is, you know, the commitment you have to make to that business to get it to a critical mass. And it's not only hours, but there's a physical and kind of mental toll. I'll tell you a quick story. So, you know, especially when I lost my job and, you know, here I am the sole provider of my household. I'm trying to get this thing going. I worked every billable hour that I could deliver personally, because if, let's just say that we're charging $200 an hour, if I didn't have to pay an employer or a contractor, that $200 goes straight to me, right? And I have bills to pay as a house. So I worked an insane amount. And the toll that took is my health. And not a story I really kind of told publicly, but some people, but I think it would be good for other entrepreneurs to know, is that gained 35 pounds, started drinking, which is not healthy, but, you know, I got into, and I didn't drink during the week before I was an entrepreneur. And then you bust your butt all day and you come downstairs or shut down work. And then that was kind of your reward. It was kind of a ritual that kind of started. Well, at one point in probably about three years ago, I was trying to get additional life insurance and disability insurance. My financial planner's like, you know, you're not really covered. If something happens to you, you know, you need to have something. So what happened was, I went, you know, as you go through the underwriting process for life insurance and disability insurance, I found out that I had let my health get so bad, I was uninsurable.
Oops.
I could not get insurance. No matter what premium I was willing to pay, no one would insure me because I let my health get so poor. So, I mean, you will take a physical toll if you're not careful and very aware of that. Now, the good news is, a year later, I get my act together, drop 30 pounds, cut back on the drinking, and start having a more healthy lifestyle. But it was a real wake-up call. And that's some of the, you know, people kind of look at, you know, hey, it's glamorous and stuff like that. But it takes a toll. It takes a toll on your family because you're taking time away from them, your health. So I just, you know, not saying it's as glamorous as everybody thinks about it. It's a lot of hard work.
Well, kudos on getting fit again.
I guess the other big challenge I would say is, you know, just realize Salesforce is seasonal. And just a statistic, if people don't know it, that Salesforce closes 43% of their annual contract value in Q4, which ends in January. It's hard to run a company for one quarter, right? Because you're staffing, right? So how do you keep the cash flow going when you've got a very seasonal business where you're selling something today, delivering something tomorrow, and then you're waiting 60 days to get paid, right, from the time you sold it? So it's really hard to get past that kind of cash flow hurdle when you're trying to scale, right? Because the money comes so much later after you've delivered the work. So that's a real hard problem for early consulting companies to ramp on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course it makes sense. I mean, I didn't know about the cycle thing, but I definitely know from the customers that, you know, January is a really good time to negotiate contracts, you know, and that makes sense right now. So if anyone is looking to renew their contracts, now is the time to get those discounts. So I would quickly like to touch on the other topic that you mentioned, a little bit about mental and physical health. You know, I am a meditation practitioner and I love my Headspace app. Shout out to Headspace. So what did you do to battle that? Are you into meditation, yoga, or workout? What's your choice?
I think for me, it was getting back in a regular kind of workout regime. So, you know, for me today, it's 3 to 5 days a week. My team knows that by 6 o'clock, I've pretty much shut down for the day. And then I start my day at 5 a.m. and I have a recumbent kind of lean back bike with a big stand over it. And that I will cycle for an hour and catch up on email to get ahead of the day. And then I'll work out a little bit and stuff like that. But that's, you know, that's a healthy change. It's interesting you say that because there's some other MVPs and business owners that I've talked to that do the meditation, the Headspace app and some other things, and they find it incredibly helpful. I've not made that investment, but I have heard it is very helpful for many people.
Yeah, and I have this family pack where I can invite people and I'm gifting it. It's the best gift that you can give anyone. And one more thing, not everybody, I think, is also cut out for entrepreneurship. And it also takes part with your partners. For example, I think when you're an entrepreneur, you're running a company, it's a 24/7 job, you know, and your partners and people also have to accept it, or you need to set boundaries. Like, for example, my girlfriend right now, I have a strict no phone policy at dinner table.
No, I agree. You've got to communicate to your spouse or your significant other what is ahead. I don't think it's one of those, I didn't know what I didn't know. So I don't think I prepared my wife necessarily well for what life is going to look like. So it's something that you really need to kind of keep that communication going and make sure you keep that work-life balance. And you've got to set time, you know, I've got an 11-year-old daughter, right, that wants to see dad. So, you know, you've got to set boundaries even with work. And that's something I've really figured out only the last couple of years that, okay, you know, you cannot work every weekend and not see your family. Like, you've got to carve out time. And again, for me, it's 6 o'clock, shut it down, you know, and that's my boundary. And I go, whatever happens, I will pick it up tomorrow at 5 a.m. It will be there and nothing's going to happen overnight that I can't respond to in the morning, because then I can focus. But you've got to set boundaries. Even for work.
Absolutely. And that's the whole idea about this show. And thank you for sharing it so that people can learn from us, you know, as much as they can. But everybody learns by himself, but I hope they learn from us. All right, continuing this, what would be your advice or top three tips for budding forcepreneurs or people, you know, who would like to start a business, or and how does one do that in America? You know, so you're in USA, how does one start a company? Like, you know, somebody who's a developer, or there are a lot of people coming from other backgrounds there, you know. So what are your three tips and how does one start a company?
Yeah, my three tips, I was kind of thinking about that before the call, is, you know, one, if all possible, run on cash. Try not to borrow, try not to run up a line of credit. If you have cash and you have some kind of working capital that you've held back in reserves, you can take advantages of opportunities when they come available. Whether it's, hey, a great talent just happened, came available, and I want to have this person on my team, or there's a marketing opportunity that you think that would be great. It's tough, right? It's super tough when you're scaling to hold any kind of war chest back. But if you can run on cash, you're doing better probably than 95% of all startups, if you can keep that revenue ahead of your burn rate. The other tip I would say is legal expenses is worth every penny. You know, make sure you're not just stealing stuff off of LegalZoom or your old employer's contracts. Get an attorney that you can sit down, explain what you do, what is your business model, educate them on how you work. Having good legal counsel allows me to sleep at night. So I know that if we did an agreement with a company, they've reviewed it, they've explained the risks at play, what's my exposure. And if you have good legal counsel, you'll make sure that it's kind of like buying insurance. Like, you know what worst case scenario will be. And I can sleep at night because I know that I have not inadvertently put my company at risk of 9 years because I made a bad legal decision. You know, when you're doing red lines back and forth with a customer, one edit, one red line can look very innocuous, but it can unravel a bunch of protection that you're not aware about because you're not an attorney. That's not your skill set. So that don't be afraid to spend money on legal is my mm-hmm. thought, because it will give you a lot of peace of mind that you can sleep at night. There's different business models for different people. I like being a sole owner. So, you know, the advice would be the best partner is no partner. That doesn't work for everybody. Some people, I know some great folks that run a great consulting shop that have partners and they get along, you know, swimmingly and great. But, you know, if you let go of ownership of your company through investment or through a partnership, this decision is no longer solely yours. You're going to spend a lot of time trying to get consensus of those decisions. And then if you have an outside investor that owns a big stake of your company, a lot of your focus is now going to be justifying what you're doing to that investor, right? So you have to justify what you're spending, how you're running the company, and that mental energy and time you could be doing other things with. It's not for everybody. Like, if you can't do it alone, I totally get that. But if you can retain sole ownership, I think you'll spend less time justifying what you're doing every day, more time working on the business. In terms of ramping a company, there's lots of ways to do it. Obviously, mine started with a bit of a side hustle. As soon as I kind of got through the first 6 months and I said, hey, you know what? I've now got 2-3 people working with me. The next step was to get an LLC, right? To get that legal separation of you and what you're doing. And so by 2011, after the first 6 months, that was one of the first things I did. And then you start realizing other tools. You know, payroll was incredibly painful for me. We use Gusto, which is an, it used to be Zen Payroll. And the only reason I picked them is because Mark Benioff was an investor in it. So I thought, well, if Mark thinks it's cool, you know, I'll use it. And that's just made payroll so easy, whether it's a full-time employee or contractors and trying to figure out deductions and stuff like that. So that, that will alleviate a lot of that. And then also, you know, you need to leverage some professional relationships. Some people are comfortable with the finances and QuickBooks and stuff like that. I use a CPA. So I deliver a packet of information of my business to a CPA, and they do all my P&Ls and cash flow statements and all that stuff, you know, to kind of make it legitimate and stuff like that. But you're going to have to start using some outside resources to do that. But the first step, if you think this is just not a fluke and this is not a one-off project and you think there's going to be ongoing stuff, the first step is an LLC.
Okay. And quickly, how does one start an LLC in USA? Like, where do you need to go register? I'm from India and Europe, so I know how it works here. So
yeah, I use an attorney. So I have an attorney that I've used for a lot of stuff that's
okay,
knows me. So that was a good first step because they had done it many times. They knew the process. They got me what's called an EIN number, which is your identification number as an employer, right? Rather than your personal social security number. So again, it's kind of your professional relationships that and what I had. So I, through that person, they were able to give me kind of stewardship through that process and made it really easy for me. So yeah, it was pretty, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
All right. Fair enough. Okay. So that was really nice. That was really nice talking about the business part of things and, you know, how to get all started. And thank you. I think people can learn definitely a lot from your journey. And now getting a little more on the personal side. So whom do you look up to for inspiration as an entrepreneur? Like, is there someone or is this, I mean, you don't have to follow his steps, but someone you're like, wow, okay, I can take something from this guy.
Yeah, I think I've got two people in mind that for me is fairly self-evident. And then I think there's a bunch of smaller players that people have no idea who they are. So Steve Jobs and Mark Benioff. I've been using Apple products since high school in the 80s. And I was just thinking about that question and like, well, what do I do all day? I'm in Salesforce and use Apple products in my consumer life, personal life. And I think, you know, their vision, tenacity and all that, it's pretty amazing. And obviously I owe Mark Benioff my career, right? I mean, I would not have this career had I not got on Salesforce software. The other angle I think I would take on that is how do I explain this? So I joined Entrepreneurs Organization, EO, which is a professional entrepreneurs organization. It's all over the world, chapters everywhere. And a couple other MVP buddies of mine, Jason Lawrence in Australia and Gary Palmateer in New York were EO members and turned me onto it. And one of my big struggles is like, okay, I've done a really good job or a decent job of getting my company to this level. And then I started wondering, well, what happens at 10 million? What happens at 15 million? What happens as you keep growing? What am I not thinking about? And EO is just another group of entrepreneurs where you can see, share ideas, experience shares of what they're doing. And I just want to make sure I was doing good stewardship for my company, that I was doing everything I could. So that was helpful. And I will tell you, I get inspiration listening to EO members about how they ramp their business. I think it's fascinating. And these are people you've never heard of. And then even a lot of our customers, when we're working with them, they talk about their business. And when I was a consultant, kind of learning all these different business models, you know, I've done over, you know, well over 100 Salesforce implementations and seen all sorts of business models, products, services, recurring revenue models, service business, you know, you name it. It's just, you know, just learn from your customers too. I mean, there's always an opportunity to learn from people that you interact with. So either, you know, professionally, socially, your customers, I think you got to think of all these other people that can inspire you.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the perks of working as a consultant, right? I mean, you work with multiple customers, you see how they are doing business, and you can take some learning from them. You can see what's working, what's not working, and then you can kind of modify it and make it suit your own needs. You know, no one size fits all. You can get inspired from them, let's call it like that. And then you can use that in your own company in a different way or in a similar way. So I think that's, yeah, one of the great perks of being a consultant.
So I personally love to read and I read a lot of books. So what would be the one book that you would recommend or that had an impact on you or maybe more?
That's a tough one. So when I started the company, I kind of stopped reading and just worked a lot. But I used to read a lot of books. I was a big fan of like Guy Kawasaki and some others.
Okay.
But the only book that I'm really kind of diving back into right now is a book called Traction. It's a pretty popular in the EEO circles by a person named Gino Wickman.
Okay.
And then kind of in the absence of reading, I got really into podcasts because it were easy to consume nuggets of information of kind of business stories. It kind of, and I could throttle it, you know, how I needed to. And it was, whether I was on a plane, I didn't have to have the book with me. And if I had a moment, whether it's even walking around, you know, picking out groceries, I'm listening to a podcast. I mean, it's an easy way for me to consume information. So a couple of the podcasts that I really like about business, How I Built This by Guy Raz is really pop. I like that one. And then Masters of Scale by Reid Hoffman, who's ex-LinkedIn. Yeah. And then those are the two ones that I kind of listen to. I just love the stories about how people start with an idea,
yeah,
got traction, tried to scale, what they had to overcome. You know, I just love those stories. I think they're great. And then other podcasts I listen to try to keep mental balance. So a lot of them are not time I'm spending learning about business. It's just stuff I want to listen to just kind of keep sanity, if that makes sense.
All right. So we are slowly coming to the end of the show. Do you have any favorite quotation that you like?
Yeah, I don't. I thought about that and I was like, there's nothing written on my wall. There's not a saying that I say, you know, every week. I did kind of think about that. And, you know, I think a lot of that, you know, from a success standpoint is, to me, it's kind of like trust your gut. Your gut's usually kind of right more than not. And then I think with life, you know, I think all of us can be successful if we can make more good decisions than bad. You know, obviously you're making decisions based on the information that you have at that time. But, you know, just kind of don't dwell on the mistakes, learn something from it. But, you know, in life, you know, if you can make more good decisions than bad, you'll probably be okay.
Fair enough. So thank you so much. So something that I have kept a secret and I've not told you, I'm doing a small rapid fire round. And now you just have to be quick. You have to be on a wit and the questions are not that hard, you know. So there are a bunch of questions and I'll just go through them real quickly. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Windows or Mac?
Mac.
GUI or CLI?
CLI being?
Command line interface.
Oh,
or GUI. Graphical user interface.
Yeah, GUI. I can't code.
Okay. Ebooks or hard copy?
I still like hard copy.
Me too. Are you a morning person or a night person?
Morning is more productive for me by far.
Your choice of morning routine: meditation, yoga, jogging, workout, journaling.
Workout.
Which city do you like to travel to for business?
San Francisco. I really like San Francisco.
And favorite holiday destination?
Something with water. It could be a lake, okay. It could be a river, it could be the ocean, just water.
As a business traveler, which hotel chain is the best value for money?
I'm pretty loyal to Marriott, so
yeah,
what I would is say a good value? I don't know.
Will you use their Wi-Fi? Okay.
Exactly. I owe them for the Wi-Fi.
Yes or no? Can Google be dethroned?
I don't think so.
It's a no.
That's a no.
All right. That was your rapid fire round. We have come to the end of the show, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for sharing your story with us. It's really inspirational how you began from such humble beginnings of starting a blog to share knowledge, and then you got fired. And by sheer hard work and dedication,
You know, you build it into this big behemoth and a multi-million dollar business, and now you're providing jobs and opportunities to others. So I think your story is very inspirational. Apart from that, I'm really happy that you shared some of the other side of entrepreneurship, and you were not shy in talking about your mental health and the toll it took on your physical health and how you battled those and you came on top. So thank you. I look forward to meeting you in person.
Oh, Ankit, totally enjoyed it. I appreciate you reaching out. And I was very, very happy and honored that you had reached out to me. Thank you so much.
That's it for now, folks. Thanks for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, check out the other episodes. Please like, share, and subscribe to Forcepreneur. We are available on all major platforms. If you have feedback about any episode or would like me to interview someone, please go to www.forcepreneur.com and let me know. I will get back to you as soon as I can. This is Ankit Taneja signing out. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.